Greetings and salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here with you for the week of Friday, November 15th of the year 2019. How's it going, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages? I am Mike the Legend, who's glad to be back with you once again after we were away last week. We had intended to use our recording time, normally allotted last week, to go see Terminator Dark Fate. As it happens, plans went awry. Dennis was a little bit under the weather, so we had to delay our viewing of Terminator to just earlier this week. So we did get to see it, and perhaps we'll touch on it a bit later. Safe to say, a better experience than seeing Rambo Last Blood.
That's to put it lightly. And this week, I'm Dennis, the man who still doesn't know how he feels about the fact that Sonic the Hedgehog was redesigned for the Sonic the Hedgehog movie.
Being very timely and topical, given the fact that the new trailer for the upcoming Sonic the Hedgehog movie just dropped earlier this week. And it sounds like you are mixed or just haven't really formed an opinion yet on the redesign of Sonic the Hedgehog for the Sonic the Hedgehog movie. Is it the concept that it was redesigned or the design itself that you can't quite wrap your brain around yet, or perhaps something else about the whole package?
First of all, I'm going to side with the general internet and say, yes, Sonic looks more like Sonic in this new trailer. Like, there's no denying that. But as someone who is an artistic person, I can't help but still feel like, wow, like, so like, if you release a teaser for something and everyone craps all over it, you're just gonna bow to the will of everyone and just not follow through with your art. But then I also have to like, again, take a step back and go, yeah, but this isn't really art. This is like a big corporation doing a thing. And yeah, this is less an art piece and more of like a way to like, this is a commercial investment. And fine, like, I'll accept that, but I'm also kind of mind-boggled at the fact that instead of, you know, like, we've seen debacles in the past where things are just sort of, like, shat all over, like, where the internet will have none of it, they'll look at it and go, nope, we're out. And then, you know, the company who's going to put it out kind of just ends up burying it, and it just becomes a box office flop. That's what normally happens, and that's why, like, part of me is kind of looking at this, you know, blown away that the fact that instead of, like, basically rolling over, laying down, and going, ah, we've invested our money, we're gonna cut off this, you know, project at the knees because it's clearly a lost cause. Instead of doing that, they're actually, you know, doing, you know, the thing to try to actually make it more right in the eyes of the fans, which is kind of mind-blowing. And you don't really see it very often.
Yeah, they're going back and investing more money, apparently, to try and right what was perceived by the general public or general viewing public as a wrong in terms of the appearance of Sonic in that first trailer from several months ago. So it's an interesting whole scenario, and I get your point about the artistic merit, if there was to be any with this project, but certainly there had to have been some people involved who had to design, formulate, and come up with what the appearance would be for Sonic, as we saw in that first trailer. They were paid to do the work and come up with it, and come up with it they did. And I'm sure they have mixed feelings about this, that they were being sent back to the drawing board basically by the comment section of the internet.
Yeah. And like the other thing that's kind of like weird to me about this, like, like everyone now has the in hindsight opinion of, well, you know, how did it get to this point? Like how did all these people let Sonic look like this? And it's like, well, hold on. Actually, maybe it's the fact that, you know, they had buy-in at every level. Like this didn't just get all the way to the trailer point with, you know, no one looking at it. Like, all of the shareholders would have had to have signed off on a project like this. All of the producers, all of, like, the executive producers, all of the companies involved who are acting in an executive production capacity. They all would have to have people look at it at least once and go, yep, looks good. We're excited for this.
Some sort of studio head, head of distribution or production, like at least one studio head for whichever movie studio is involved with this. The particular one is escaping me at this moment, but it doesn't really matter because if it's Fox, Warner Brothers, Disney, whomever is behind it, there would be someone who would have to be responsible and sign off on it, even if they're the senior VP of marketing.
It is Paramount Pictures, and I remember that distinctly because of the Sonic the Hedgehog kind of gag that they did at the, with the Paramount logo, changing the stars that go around the mountain thing into rings. But,
gotcha.
But
gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. So Paramount, so someone from the Paramount head office, someone who's paid very handsomely, signed off on the appearance of Sonic and that first trailer. So,
well, someone from Paramount, as well as probably someone from, Sega, as well as the director, as well as the producer of the movie, like all of these people looked at this at least once and went, yep, looks good.
And it's not a design that would have been done overnight or any sort of rush job. There would have been time, thought, and multiple concepts drawn up for that look and appearance as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And yet it was still made it to the internet looking like that and then in some ways forcing. We can certainly have a discussion on the comment section of the internet getting its way and forcing people back to the drawing boards to fix something that there was a massive outcry over, even though there was some level of artistic merit to it. And of course that line of discussion makes me think back to the retake Mass Effect campaign of a number of years ago,
which yeah.
is a similar idea where the comment section of the internet were unhappy with what BioWare and EA did and tried to get them to fix it and no.
Yeah, it's like sometimes you just have to live with how a movie or a game or an album or something is. Like, I get in this discussion with, like, my dad all the time about the Godfather franchise, like, as it's, you know, a franchise that both of us enjoy, but, you know, he hates the third movie, he hated the ending of the third movie, I love the ending of the third movie, and it's like, I think the general opinion is that people don't like the third movie, but if people had the outcry back then, like if there was the comment section back then, would they have actually changed the third Godfather movie? I don't know. Like I would have maybe been like, I mean, I wouldn't have seen the final cut or I wouldn't have seen the cut of the movie that we knew now if that's the case. And I don't know. I like that. I like the movie. I recognize like it has weak parts and stuff, but like this is just one example I have. Like if, like what would have that movie looked like then? Like what, like if we start applying this logic to all sorts of pieces of art and things throughout history, like maybe things that were controversial at the time or whatever, like how many classic pieces of art would we lose? I'm going to take a very hearty step back and say, I don't know if this Sonic the Hedgehog movie is going to be the hill that I am willingly dying on for this because, you know, obviously like I'm not. Like, I recognize what this movie is. It's just basically, you know, Sega and everything is just trying to get Sonic the Hedgehog back in the public consciousness. Maybe they're trying to ramp up for another game. Whatever. It's a way to make money. It's a cash in on 90s nostalgia. You know, a lot of us millennials, again, have money now because we're in our mid-30s and the things that we grew up with, we can spend more money on now because we have good paying jobs, some of us. Others, maybe not so much, but regardless, we're movie-going age and we can spend money on things. Fine, I get it. But still, like, think of how many, you know, albums, movies, books, paintings have been kind of like caught the ire of the public over the years that later on kind of developed into things that actually have like either a cult following or have just kind of become pieces of classic art because maybe times have warmed to them or something. and people kind of recognize, oh, actually, no, this is great. Like,
it's true. That's an interesting discussion to certainly have. And again, you made the point earlier, how many things would have been changed if there was the comment section of the internet, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, for these pieces like, of art, be they movies.
Even going back hundreds of years, like not even just like within recent memory, like think of like, even going back to like Shakespeare, like I'm sure there were plays that Shakespeare put out, or like poems or sonnets or whatever that he put out that people didn't like at the time, that now scholars look at and, you know, crap their pants over and like really want to overanalyze now in the context of, you know, we're with the benefit of 400 or 500 years behind us, like, oh, what was Shakespeare thinking here? Let's overanalyze this. But at the time, people might have been like, that's a body bunch of crap. Like, I don't know.
Now, we're going down the artistic vein of conversation around the Sonic the Hedgehog trailer, but the much more likely scenario is that it was a financially driven calculation on the part of Paramount, Sega, and all the other producers and executive producers, given the blowback involved and the poor reception that the trailer had based on the appearance of Sonic, that sent them to the drawing board to rejig and redo and come up with a much more game-centric appearance for Sonic in the movie. And, of course, yes, it looks like a no-brainer that this is how Sonic should appear. Why did the first one ever happen? And now, in comparison, the Sonic from the first trailer looks like a cheap Chinese knockoff.
Yeah, yeah. But, like, I still wonder, like, where were the, like, don't they normally do, like, focus group screenings and things? Like, test screenings?
They do. That's a normal part of a movie production process, to bring in people from different walks of life or a specific target demographic to gauge their reception on whatever product, TV show or movie that is being put out. And then if it tests well, it goes forward. If it doesn't, then it's back to the drawing board for some scenes or some editing. But I don't know. We're also having this conversation a bit preemptively because the movie has not come out yet.
Yeah.
So we don't know what the full experience is going to be like, even though Sonic has now been, redesigned and looks much more as, it appears in the classic video games. The movie as a whole could still be hot garbage.
I mean, if I'm being honest, it doesn't really look much better of a movie than the original trailer did. Like, they both kind of look like, eh. Like, it's effectively Detective Pikachu, but Sonic the Hedgehog. Except without the snarky humor of Ryan Reynolds. Which was the thing which is the thing that kind of sold me on Detective Pikachu. Like Ryan Reynolds being Ryan Reynolds as Pikachu was kind of like, oh, well, this is, could actually be pretty fun. This doesn't even have that. This is just like, oh, so it's Sonic the Hedgehog. Okay, great.
Sonic the Hedgehog with the character itself having a lot more attitude and snappy comebacks and one-liners, and this new trailer also doing a better job to, I guess, kind of portray Sonic as Sega really tried to do with the second and third games, that, and also one of the cartoon series from the 90s, that Sonic has attitude.
Well, that's the thing, though. Like, I didn't actually, I mean, I got more of the attitude, I guess, with the newest trailer, but I didn't get, like, full Sonic attitude? Because, I mean, mind you, everything in the 90s was, like, dripping with crazy attitude. For those of us who might be young enough to not remember, everything was kind of at 11 all the time in, like, you know, stuff aimed at, like, preteen boys, basically. Like, Ninja Turtles, Sonic the Hedgehog, Biker Mice from Mars, Street Sharks. Like, all of, like, there's so many different things were like, oh, the characters had a moment like this, where they're like, really? Well, excuse me, like, they were all like that.
So let us not forget about the extreme Ghostbusters cartoon.
I actually did forget about that. Remind us.
Yes. Well, you see, friends, it was a very short-lived series, I believe, maybe one, possibly two seasons, but it was a new Ghostbusters cartoon for a new generation, and it literally was called Extreme Ghostbusters. It featured only two of the original Ghostbusters, I believe the equivalent of Dan Aykroyd and Ernie Hudson's characters, teaching a new generation of a new crop of Ghostbusters to bust ghosts around New York City, and they were all a very politically correct and diverse cast of characters that they were training, of the four or five they had, and they were all young, and they were just all snarky, dripping with attitude. I think the female character had some sort of bright-colored, more punk-style haircut. And it, again, it literally was called Extreme Ghostbusters.
Oh, man. Well.
Yeah, in your face all the time.
Yeah. But yeah, all of everything in the 90s was like that. So this didn't actually have the 90s level of attitude, if I'm being perfectly honest. But it had more attitude than the first trailer did. I'll admit that.
It did, and I think as you rightly, as you noticed and pointed out to me earlier before we started this recording process, that the second trailer seemed to feature less Jim Carrey as Dr. Robotnik
than
the first trailer did.
Since I had to, you know, have a refresher on the first trailer, since I actually forgot it existed entirely, for some reason it must have been a Mandela effect thing where I thought, well, maybe they didn't even release a trailer. Like, I got all conspiracy theory hat wearing, like tinfoil hat wearing with it, thinking, oh, well, maybe there was no trailer. Maybe they just put out these test pictures just to see as a marketing ploy, just to say, oh, we're here's Sonic, and then know that everyone's going to get mad at this bad looking Sonic and then go, actually, here's the real trailer. We fixed him. Hooray. But no, you reminded me, no, there was actually a trailer, and I watched it again, and I noticed about Jim Carrey was in about half of the scenes, like half of the screen time was probably filled with Jim Carrey, whereas the new trailer, his appearances were at a kind of a minimum.
They were, and I wonder if that perhaps was deliberate, perhaps the Jim Carrey portrayal of Dr. Robotnik maybe didn't test as well in the wake of that first trailer. Of course, overshadowed by the appearance of Sonic in that first trailer. But I find it kind of hard to watch Jim Carrey as Dr. Robotnik in this trailer, both of them, from what we've seen thus far. And I say that because it seems like he's channeling a very much over-the-top energy, very over-the-top performance, kind of in the vein of, say, The Mask Ace Ventura.
Here's the interesting thing. Of all of the aspects of the movie, his character is the most true to the 90s attitude, if I'm being honest. Now, whether or not that's a good thing, I don't know. But if I'm being perfectly honest, Jim Carrey's Dr. Robotnik in this movie is a very, he's playing it very 90s, which is kind of interesting.
True, which would explain why he's carrying on that same energy that he did with some of his early 1990s movies. Again, Ace Ventura, The Mask, and whatnot. But perhaps the disconnect for me is, watching Jim Carrey perform in this very over-the-top way, which we've seen him do before, as I just cited moments ago, but also knowing in the back of my head, he's a 60-year-old man.
Yeah, he's not young.
And I've seen that shtick from him before in the 90s, so basically 25 years ago.
Yeah, when he was in his 30s, like, fine, maybe.
So I don't know if, I mean, you know, don't want to get all ageist here and whatnot, but I don't know if that's a role for a 60-year-old man to be playing in an over-the-top fashion. Now, I don't know who you get to play Dr. Robotnik, but I don't know. This feels like a weird casting choice to me. maybe not as weird as Dennis Hopper as Bowser in the original Super Mario Brothers movie, but
or Raul Julia as M. Bison.
Oh, I'm sorry. That is a fantastic casting choice.
I mean, it's true. There's no one I would pick over Raul Julia for that role. I mean,
like, as terrible as that Street Fighter movie ended up being, Raul Julia was the only choice, in hindsight, the only choice for M. Bison, and Jean-Claude Van Damme, the only choice for Guile.
Yeah. Exactly. But, yeah, I don't know. Very interesting. I don't know if the redesign of Sonic makes me want to see the movie anymore, which, you know, it is what it is, I guess. Maybe I'll watch it. Maybe if it comes to Netflix or whatever, like, that'll probably be it for me. Like, it looks like it's trying to capture the same energy that Detective Pikachu did, except it doesn't have, Ryan Reynolds, you know, swinging around big Deadpool energy.
And even then, it was a bit of a toned down Ryan Reynolds from Deadpool energy, too.
Yeah.
Which, of course, would make sense because it was a family movie.
It was for children, yes. Deadpool is not for children.
So we'll see. We'll see what subsequent trailers of the new Sonic the Hedgehog movie provide, and if they sway Dennis or myself one way or the other. I can easily see myself when this movie comes out. I believe next February or
yeah,
it's in the first couple months of next year anyway. I can easily see myself getting roped into taking my niece or nephew or both of them to see this movie. So there's an entirely real scenario where I see this in the theater, and like I'm sure many others out there as well who are our age, and perhaps will take their kids or will take a niece or a nephew or whatever the case might be, or just go see it themselves to see, you know, their 90s video game icon, see how it translates to the big screen for the first time.
Yeah. We have a show we'll to actually get into
in
here.
The weeks ahead, and yes, we do have a show to get into, and we will get into our first of two ludicrous leadoffs here, which takes us into a realm that we like to dip our toe into every so often, the realm of science going crazy, and how appropriate that we just watched Terminator Dark Fate the other day. Of course, the Terminator franchise based entirely around the machine uprising and destruction and subsequent destruction of humanity, and we have a story about an AI system that is now further developed, further advanced, and able to beat some of the world's best players at StarCraft 2.
Yeah, so one of the OG esports games, I would say, StarCraft 2, which still, if I'm not mistaken, has a massive following in South Korea. And
Sounds right to me.
I mean, the world over in general, but I mean, like, it's not the most popular game out there these days, but still, it's been around for a long enough time that, you know, there's different rankings of players that have developed, I guess. I don't know how official the rankings are, but there are people who can be considered grandmasters at StarCraft 2 when you're playing against other players. And, you know, much like chess grandmasters, they have to be thinking, you know, several steps ahead and have to know exactly what the right strategy is when going up against whoever, what other type of player. When you're playing this type of game, like if you're playing as, you know, Terrans, Protoss, or Zerg, whatever, you need to kind of know the strengths and weaknesses and all the different ins and outs of each race and how they, you know, interact with all the other races and stuff. And there's some deep strategy involved in StarCraft 2. And for games that have deep strategy like this, I mean, chess is one thing because, well, I don't know. We're basically talking about how someone trained an AI to be really good at StarCraft 2. But not just really good, but like absolute top tier best, can best all the best players good.
Yes, it's basically an unbeatable StarCraft II playing system.
Yeah.
And it's all artificial intelligence developed by the DeepMind organization, which is owned by Google's parent company, Alphabet. So it's a sibling company to Google itself under the umbrella of Alphabet. And we have spoken of DeepMind before because as part of their quest to develop Skynet and the system that will eventually destroy all of mankind, they have previously developed AI systems capable of not just playing the ancient game of Go, but becoming very, very unbeatable at it, beating, I believe, not just the European champion, but also the world grand champion of Go, which was a big deal at the time when we spoke about it, because Go is a rather open-ended game with a whole lot of possible moves, seemingly at any point in your contest, in your playthrough. And DeepMind has also built AI systems capable of playing chess and being very successful at chess and also in poker as well. But StarCraft II, they built one that is capable of being ranked above the 99.8 percentile of active players on Battle.net. So it's basically it's a 0.2% system. It's in the top 2% of players.
Yeah.
So good for the developers, bad for us, the fleshies who are still walking around for now.
Well, bad for us, the fleshies who are still playing StarCraft II. I think that's the kind of interesting thing you need to kind of always, I mean, the more and more I learn about computer stuff and the more I know about AI and stuff, the more I have to kind of like bring it in. And thankfully, a Skynet situation would never actually happen. It just wouldn't. And the reason for that is that AI gets really good at doing one thing that you obsessively train it to do. Like, you won't be able to apply this StarCraft AI to anything but playing StarCraft. Like, at all. It doesn't work that way.
So it's not as though they could then take the system that was, you know, the room of servers and computational hardware behind this StarCraft II playing bot and then plug it in and start running numbers to predict the next financial collapse or anything like that.
No. To do that, you would need to train an AI with all of the financial information for the last 100 years, 200 years. For it, like, basically, but then you'd also need to train it with other external influences and stuff, basically, to try to see what was happening in the news at the time to see if it can form any correlations and stuff. Training AI is really hard, really time consuming, and really narrow in what you can train it to do. Like, it's, we're so far off from AI being like, gaining some, the sentience that like a lot of these, like science fiction things and stuff posit. It's mind blowing to think of how hard that would be. Now, having said that, of course, Alphabet and their infinite budgets and coffers and stuff, I wouldn't put it past them if there is some crazy stuff that they've been working on that is Skynet basically. But, yeah, I don't know. Like, if this is, maybe they're just releasing these stories to kind of like placate us, to be like, oh, see, we've trained an AI to play StarCraft. It's like, oh, well, that's pretty harmless then. Okay, fine. It's like, yeah, you got one that's good at Go, you got one that's good at StarCraft, you got other students making AIs to play Mario Brothers. Oh, they're just all a bunch of video games. Cool. Oh, you have other AIs to replace people's faces and stuff. Huh, okay. On, you know, videos. Fine. But, like, these are all very, like, I don't know, features, very specific things. It gets a little weird when you get to the natural language parsing AIs and stuff, and the ones that can actually respond conversationally. But thankfully, they're not connected to other systems and stuff. So, it's, yeah. But, yeah, it's still impressive. Like, what I was going to say about chess was, chess is sort of a solved game. There's only a certain number of moves that you can do, and it's very easy to predict the way an entire game would go based on the first move that a player does. And that's something that human players can do. Like, that's what human chess grandmasters are able to do. So for a computer to basically know how to play chess in quotation marks, they're basically, like, it doesn't even have to be AI, really. It could just be brute force. Like, oh, if they do this, pick one of these strategies at random to go against them. Like, whereas, like, a game like Go or StarCraft, where the strategy gets way more mind-blowing and, like, it opens up, like, that's where it gets more impressive to me.
Indeed, and was certainly impressive at the time, and I guess the team decided to move on to the next challenge, which they lined up as StarCraft II, which they managed to do through imitation learning, reinforcement learning, and essentially, it sounds like they taught the rules of StarCraft II to this AI system, and then kind of had it play itself almost repeatedly, and then also motivated it to basically achieve a very proficient design at getting its goals, such as gaining or losing points, and then developing effective strategies to complete that goal. So it is very effective at this. Now, we don't know what the next aim is, given that the first we're hearing of this AI system that DeepMind developed to play StarCraft II has it at the top of the charts, essentially. It has been developed and already there, whereas we kind of followed the incremental progression of the DeepMind system that was playing Go, as it would play whatever champions, move up in rank and play the European champion, move up and then play the world champion, and then crush everyone in its wake. At least with those contests, the human players took maybe one or two of the best of five games, or best of seven games. So they took some victories from the AI system, but it sounds like with what the developers at DeepMind have worked on here, there's very little room for humans to win against this DeepMind system in StarCraft II.
Yeah.
Now, as we kind of spoke about, and as you mentioned, it's not as though that this AI system is going to be directly applicable to something else right away, but the researchers are hoping that the insights that they can gain from this specific AI system could hopefully be applied elsewhere to develop systems that can help solve complex real-world problems, improve the generalization of machine intelligence, things like that, and, you know, just to, you know, break down the barriers and the walls that humans are superior to artificial intelligence in.
Yeah. But I mean, having said that though, AI getting good at stuff like this is usually a good thing, because like the idea is that we want to offload a lot of like weird, hard stuff that's really hard for humans to do to these computers to train them to do. Like just think of like the deepfake technology with face replacement on, you know, videos and stuff. Like, I'm sure we've seen all those ridiculous videos that people have made where they put like Ron Swanson's face on everybody's face on Full House, or like the things where they replace, you know, every actor with like Nicolas Cage or whatever. Like, it's ridiculous and it looks really convincingly well done. And you're able to just basically just have these videos and things like that up and running within like minutes because of like a pre-trained AI, like data model that's just able to kind of like an AI data model and like some scripts that use this data model in a very specific way. Like for humans to actually have to do that work themselves. Like if you think of the Ron Swanson Full House video, it was a stupid thing that someone probably spent 15 minutes on and then uploaded it to YouTube. And then that was it. But like, considering how well done it looks and how like seamless it is, for a person to actually do the work themselves, it probably would have taken them months and months and months of just like, you know, video editing and, you know, After Effects work and whatever else, like all the stuff that would have been traditionally like really time consuming and hard to do. Like I think, and like a good example of like an application that could have Like movies are like where AI really can help. Like if you think about that the last Superman movie starring Henry Cavill that came out, a couple years ago? 2-3 years ago?
Are you going to get into his mustache?
Exactly. So they called him back for reshoots, but he was already filming another movie at the time and he had a mustache and he wasn't allowed to shave it. So instead of working out a deal or something where he could just shave his mustache, they edited it out and it apparently cost them millions of dollars to do. And it looked weird because they had to use computer animation and stuff. Like they had to get an artist to basically mask all the frames using computer animation and it ended up looking weird and unnatural. Someone used this deepfake technology, using Henry Cavill's clean shaven Superman face as the input to, they found the test footage with his mustache and they replaced that using it and it looked way cleaner than the computer animated hand done one. And it was done by someone on just a personal computer in 15 minutes with a pre-made script. So I feel that that's sort of like AI is going to change the world in small ways like that, which are kind of interesting. Whether or not that takes a job away from someone, I don't know, but I guess that's just progress, right? I it's hard to say whether or not that's a good or bad thing, but I can see where the research for this AI for StarCraft could go. I mean, they're not there yet, obviously. There's no direct takeaways, but I think with all of the different ways that they would have had to train it and all of the different techniques they used to train the AI, maybe it'd be interesting to see what they figured out as inputs as training. Like, I think that's where the value comes from. Maybe they can start using the inputs were actually we saw that whenever players go like this, we found that the AI learned to do this or whatever. And then that could be maybe learned to help even train, I don't know, boxers to be better boxers or you through AI or train. There's so many different weird aspects that AI could help in different ways. It could be good, but also could be bad. It could be Skynet. I'm just going to also cover my ass and say that. So in the weird chance that Skynet does happen, I don't want to be one of the skulls that are immediately crushed on by a T-800.
Someone somewhere, for all the benign AI research that is, that we hear about being done by DeepMind or something, someone somewhere is working on a Skynet.
Probably, yeah.
That is the balance of the universe, I suppose, until it just all goes kablooey and we're all doomed to become just piles of skulls. But let's move on to our second ludicrous leadoff, and talk about a story that is a lot more mundane. A lot more mundane, a lot less moving parts, a lot less complex, if you will, and a game that's in the vein of a game that was never actually officially a game. You've heard us talk about something called Desert Bus on this program previously, and it's a game that never actually saw the light of day, but has developed a cult community, a cult following online. If you're not familiar with it, Desert Bus is a game that isn't really a game. It's more of an experience simulator where you are the driver of a bus that is like a Greyhound bus or something that is going between Los Angeles. Oh, is it LA and Vegas or it's somewhere in Arizona and Vegas?
I think it's LA and Vegas, but yeah, it was a game that was completed. It's a real game. It just never got released. It was part of a Penn and Teller game pack that was basically, I think it was like Penn and Teller's the game or something or
Smoke and Mirrors.
Smoke and Mirrors. Yeah. That's what it was. So it was a Penn and Teller game. It was part of this game and it was basically supposed to be a meta commentary on maybe video games in general or something, or maybe the whole simulation genre and how ridiculous it could get. It's effectively a real time bus ride from, like you said, I think it was Las Vegas to Los Angeles. And I think it takes you 6 hours to complete because you drive in real time through the Mojave Desert. And every single time you complete the trip, you get 1 point. You can, and then once you get from point A to point B, you turn around and go from point B to point A. And then you just keep going back and forth. And that's the whole game. And, you know, over the years, the Loading Ready Run people, have turned this into a yearly, telethon style charity, called Desert Bus for Hope. And they've raised millions of dollars and all this stuff. But yeah, the long and the short of it is it's kind of like an anti game that's kind of just became popular because it was kind of a novelty, not because it was a real game that people would actually want to play.
And kind of in that vein and for that reason, we really haven't seen many other games attempt that sort of experience of Desert Bus, where it is a very mundane, very boring, and monotonous experience for several many hours. But here we are now in 2019 with news coming out earlier this week that developer Hosni Oji and publisher AMC Games, based on, you know, a branch of the AMC channel that has brought us things like The Walking Dead, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, and whatnot, have partnered up and they have unveiled Airplane Mode, which is a game that promises to deliver all the mundane highs and tedious lows of a six-hour commercial flight in real time. Those words coming from Matt Wales of Eurogamer.net. And it is Desert Bus in the sky. So you are taking a transatlantic flight, and you as the player are in the window seat of an economy class, in the economy class of a plane on this flight, and you are there for 6 hours. And you have a, quote, you experience, quote, the most realistic flight simulation ever created, end quote. So take that, Microsoft Flight Simulator. So you get the full taxi experience, takeoff, landing, cabin crew, fellow passengers, ambient noise, so that droning hum that is persistent in the cabin when you're on a flight, that's there too. And the press release points out that the experience is randomized too, so that each playthrough that you go through will be different from the previous time and different compared to the next time. So there may be different events that come up, such as delays, turbulence, bad Wi-Fi, screaming babies, annoying passengers, things of that nature. So it is you in this experience on a plane for 6 hours.
Yeah, and it gets kind of weirder and deeper than that, though, too. Like, as you said, it will be randomized with, like, various things. And you mentioned bad Wi-Fi. Because there's a number of weird things that are included in this. There's like the complimentary aircraft information card, an overhead reading light, a fully functioning in-flight entertainment system, which, you know, has the flight safety video, that journey tracker, you know, with what they're calling fairly accurate satellite imagery of your flight path, and, I guess a selection of quote unquote hit movies from the 1930s and a copy of Stratosphere's magazine, you know, which has like various articles, crosswords and Sudoku and stuff in it. And like, apparently there's a whole wide variety, like there's other stuff in there too. Like you get a carry on luggage and you know, you can, there's stuff in there where you can fish out things like you're looking for, like, oh, maybe a charging cable because you need to plug in your cell phone. This really goes way farther beyond than Desert Bus ever did. And I,
true.
I kind of want to try this out just out of sheer morbid curiosity.
Desert Bus put you in the role of the driver of the bus. So you had to be more alert. So you couldn't be fishing for a charging cable as you're driving the bus. This, you're a passenger and it's trying to recreate an authentic passenger experience on a plane, which, is a unique idea. I will certainly give it that. I'm curious to see how accurate they actually come through with this.
I'm interested to see what the, how they're going to gamify this. Like maybe there's going to be things where it's just like, maybe there's points that you have to accumulate over this 6-hour flight. Maybe you actually have to make choices. Maybe you'll lose points for doing certain things. Like maybe you actually have to engage in conversation a bit with your, you know, the chatty passenger that sits beside you that you don't really want to talk to. Maybe there's ways of trying to avoid conversation entirely. Like, I don't, like, will you lose points if you choose the wrong snack? Like when they offer you the pretzels or the cookie? Like what? Like, I don't know. The possibilities for game stuff seem pretty rich with this, but like, admittedly, it is a very dry idea for a game.
Oh, it's a very dry idea. So, how they're going to reward you as a player, I don't know, given that anytime you're on a plane, it's a very set experience. There's no external force that can come in and bestow upon you something that you did not already have, unless you decide to splurge and pay for the in-flight Wi-Fi or splurge for the hot meal tray during your flight or whatever the case might be. But, you know, something isn't going to appear out of the ether to help you all of a sudden.
Yeah.
So, I wonder if there's, part of the randomized experience, there's just the most terrible experience where you have a screaming baby next to you, a long delay, you've got bad turbulence, so you're stuck in your seat, and you pull out the magazine from the seat pocket in front of you and all the puzzles have been, like 3/4 filled in and you can't even do those. The seat back entertainment system isn't working.
Yeah.
You know, just everything going wrong as possible in this thing. And, for the record, I very much enjoy that they include, quote, hit movies of the 1930s, because my mind immediately went to, ah, those are the ones where, they're in the public domain and you don't have to pay commercial licenses for them.
Bingo.
I wonder if the fact that it's being put on by AMC and they are a, at times, a movie broadcasting network, had any impact on the movies they were able to get for this. I don't know, but the game is being demonstrated as part of the Desert Bus for Hope event, the telethon that is happening right now as this podcast is being recorded. The full game, if you wish to call it a game, of Airplane Mode is set to launch on Steam next year. So we will certainly be talking about that once it comes out, because this is a wild idea. But in the world of indie games and whatnot, it seems like anything goes now.
Yeah, that's definitely fair and definitely very true. And also, I think if anything else, that's maybe should be kind of inspiring for anyone that wants to make a game. Because it's basically like literally choose any idea and then try to make it. And there might be a chance that someone else will play it.
Now it's on Steam. So of course there's always the problem of, developing an audience and gaining, getting people's eyeballs given the absolute bounty of games that are on Steam as, on that platform. But it's a wild enough idea, and I don't know if I've heard of too many other games in the years since Desert Bus that have attempted this concept.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's kind of narrow, though. I mean, it's you kind of have to... I don't know. Maybe that's what they were thinking when they were making it. It's like, oh, wow, we're making like an even more boring Desert Bus, and then hopefully they'll, just based on how ludicrously boring it seems, maybe they'll get some sales out of sheer morbid curiosity. Maybe they're hoping their own telethon series will start based on it as well. Who knows?
Airplane Mode for Hope.
Yeah.
But regardless, it's a wicked idea, and I'm looking forward to watching someone else play it. But not for the full 6-hour experience. I'm awaiting the condensed, sped up run through version on YouTube.
Yeah, exactly.
But, we'll move right along to a more serious news item, as it was earlier this week. pretty much anywhere around the world, it was some sort of veterans and fallen soldiers and current soldiers Remembrance Day. Where we are in Canada, it's called Remembrance Day. In the United States, it's Veterans Day. I believe in Britain, it's Armistice Day, if I'm not mistaken, or the Armistice Day could be something else, but Remembrance Day, Veterans Day, something to honor soldiers who have fought in conflicts, to give us current generation the freedoms that we enjoy. And one of the problems, challenges is a better term, challenges that the legions around the world face is trying to connect their members and their stories with a younger audience, given that there hasn't been any major worldwide conflicts for decades now, touch wood, but younger and younger generations are further and further removed from those conflicts and being able to relate to the people who were involved in those conflicts during their military service. And a very interesting idea came from the Royal Canadian Legion this year to mark the 2019's Remembrance Day. They created a custom level in Fortnite.
Yeah, so they're calling it Remembrance Island, which is a short, peaceful map for creative mode in Fortnite, where there's a number of areas that you could walk through as a player themed around a military campaign, which Canada took part in. There's no combat, no nothing. So that might be a knock against it, depending on, you know, who's playing it. But it's kind of cool sounding. You explore the level's poppy line pathways and read various snippets about, you know, the history of what happened from a Canadian perspective, of course, before coming to a final memorial, which is the recreation of the Vimy Ridge Cenotaph, where the game suggests that you salute to remember the fallen. So nice kind of idea. Hopefully it doesn't turn into like another press F to pay respects kind of meme, but I mean, it's an interesting idea.
And in announcing this new level for Fortnite, the Royal Canadian Legion said in their press release that the idea was, quote, an effort to reach this younger audience on their native turf, end quote. It's our hope that young Canadians will take a few moments to visit this unique environment and learn about the men and women who gave their lives to protect our freedom. As time goes on, we have to find new ways to reach young people and tell the story of Canadian veterans. This is a fantastic example of how to do just that, said Canadian Legion spokesman Freeman D. Shute. The level itself was put together by 19-year-old Texas-based creator Jaden JXDVN Allen, who apparently worked on it free of charge, so good for Jaden Allen for doing this for the Canadian Legion, or Royal Canadian Legion. And if you want to come across and explore this island for yourself, the code to access it, we have a link to it on our website, thearcadeshow.com, and see images of it for yourself, see a quick little video of it, check it out. This is just a really great idea and a very innovative idea from the Royal Canadian Legion. So kudos to them for branching out and not being perhaps stuck in stodgy old people ways and actually trying to actively get young people involved in the message of the Royal Canadian Legion.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a cool idea. And, you know, with the more time that passes and the more space between now and World War II and whatnot, you know, I think it's more and more important to kind of keep these things in mind, or, you know, to try to bring history back to life in more interesting ways. And yeah, kudos.
Certainly. So let's go from that story and just take a few minutes here, to kind of recap the big event from last from 2 weekends ago. We'll have our say on them, but that event was BlizzCon at the start of the month, where, of course, Blizzard announced a whole slew of new games that will be big titles that are going to generate a lot of money for them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The first of which is their newest franchise, really. But, you know, certainly not their least since, well, it's made waves in the whole esports community as sort of like the most viable of all the Blizzard titles to be, you know, something that people can watch from an esports perspective. And of course, we're talking about Overwatch.
We are indeed, and it's was announced during BlizzCon that Overwatch 2 does in fact exist. It's a real thing, and it's going to be coming out at a future point. There was no release information given. There was simply a couple trailers shown off to get people excited about it, about the fact that it exists. Whenever it does come out, it will eventually release for PC, PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and the Nintendo Switch. I'd imagine maybe sometime next year when the new consoles come out. That's just a guess entirely on my part. I have no inside information, but there was, like I said, a number of different trailers. There was a new character shown off, a number of different maps, and I guess the big deal with Overwatch 2 is that it's getting going to be an entirely new game for both PvE and PvP experiences. And it looks like there's going to be more of a story mode to Overwatch 2 as well, in addition to a number of new maps that they are basing on some real places. And as a Canadian, I believe Toronto is getting a map or some version of a map in this in Overwatch 2 as well. Some other new maps going to be based on Paris and whatnot. So Overwatch 2 also going to be able to have cross multiplayer with Overwatch 1, which is going to be interesting. So the two games, according to Jeff Kaplan, will coexist, so players of the original game can still have access to all the heroes and maps released in Overwatch 2, specifically saying, quote, "It's a shared multiplayer environment where no one gets left behind," end quote. So I'm not sure how that's going to work.
And also, what's the point of releasing this game then, if just the people who have the first one get all the benefits that they probably want out of it? I guess maybe it's just a matter of you get the single player experience, but maybe people don't care about that? I don't know.
It's a good question, because the normal process of these things is you have the first game, if it's a hit, cool, then you work and put time, effort, and money into developing the second game, and then you ideally migrate your audience over from the first game to the second game.
Yeah, I guess so. Where you still get all of your old maps and everything, too.
Like, is there maybe going to be a premium you have to pay to keep your Overwatch 1 stuff, to still have access to everything? I don't know. This is, to have the two games existing simultaneously, seems to be bucking the trend as we have come to know these games up to this point in popular gaming. So, I don't know how this is all gonna work. This is vexing to me. But yeah. It's Blizzard, and they certainly know how to make money, so I'm sure they've done a cost analysis on this.
Yeah. But speaking of Blizzard knowing how to make money and all that jazz, with this other franchise, it seemed like they almost dropped the ball last year during BlizzCon when they announced that the next entry into this franchise would be a mobile game, which they were basically met with universal boos, and like the video on YouTube got like a massive, you know, percentage of people downvoting it and stuff. But basically they drastically misread their audience for this game. And I think because of that experience last time, they wanted to make it right this time. So at this BlizzCon, they basically, in my mind, as someone who's a fan of this franchise, I think made it right. And of course, I'm now talking about Diablo. So in case you've been living under a rock and haven't heard about any of this BlizzCon stuff, Diablo 4's trailer was announced, and holy crap, is it dark.
Yes. Specifically, game director Luis Barriga said during his little portion of the stage presentation, quote, "The first thing you'll notice about Diablo 4 is we are going back to the franchise's darker roots," end quote.
Yeah. And,
and that's the first thing you noticed, I take it.
Well, if you haven't watched the trailer, I mean, like, admittedly, it's like almost 10 minutes long. It's worth watching. It's brutal. It's basically like, it's pretty metal. And yeah, it's kind of disturbing and very dark. And it just made me super excited for Diablo 4.
So it was an effective trailer, a much more effective trailer than Sonic the Hedgehog.
Oh yeah, way more effective.
Luis Barriga also said of the game, of Diablo 4, that you're going to see more of Sanctuary. Every monster and faction will have a sense of place. There are PvP zones and, of course, something that was lacking in Diablo 3. And some of the classes, the first three classes, have already been announced for Diablo 4. They will be, the first three will be the Barbarian, the Sorceress, and the Druid. Do either of those three tickle your particular fancy?
I did play, as a Barbarian and a Sorcerer in Diablo 3, so the Barbarian at the very least. Yes.
Fair enough. You'll have that in there as well. It's in development for PC, PlayStation 4, and Xbox One. And much like Overwatch 2 and its announcement, no information on a release window for Diablo 4.
And that's probably fine.
So, interesting that they're announcing these big games. Perhaps they're just still in somewhat early development, mid-development, but no release window announced for them. But at least something that did get a release window when it was announced was the next expansion to World of Warcraft, because yes, that is still going. It is not the juggernaut, it is not the powerhouse of online gaming it once was, but it is still with its dedicated audience, I should say. Granted, it's smaller in audience on a month-by-month basis than what it was a few years ago, but they are still there, they are dedicated, they are paying their dollars regularly to Blizzard. And for them, Blizzard announced the 8th expansion to the World of Warcraft series. This one is called Shadowlands, and it will come in 2020. A more firm date or specific time period we do not have, it is just 2020. And as happens with these announcements of expansions for World of Warcraft, there was a big snazzy cinematic trailer, which Blizzard does these trailers right. They make them look slick.
Oh, yeah.
And they put a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money into these trailers to make them look good. And as you pointed out, the Diablo trailer was like 8 minutes. The ones for Overwatch 2 were like 8 and 10 minutes respectively, so these are not just quick little sizzle reels they're putting together.
No, no, they're not. They're full on, like, they must have a full animation team working for them. And like, there's
basically short movies.
Yeah, there's people who work for Blizzard where their whole job must be making short movies.
And the short movies that they create are then taken and shown off at these gaming events as trailers. But they are certainly different than the industry standard of trailer, which is about 2 to 4 minutes to reveal a new game, or less than that, depending on what event and whatever the circumstances might be. But this was BlizzCon. They are preaching to the choir, and they have everyone's just rapt attention, so I guess that's when you can get away with an 8 to 10 minute reveal trailer.
Yeah. I mean, it's true.
So again, Shadowlands coming out for as the next expansion for World of Warcraft sometime in 2020. And those were the big takeaways from BlizzCon earlier this month. And again, am I alone in thinking it's a bit weird that there's no release windows for Overwatch or Overwatch 2 or Diablo 4?
I have a feeling that we're either way too early into the development cycle, or Blizzard might just drop the games on us, like, completely unexpectedly.
That'd be a hell of a thing. Something like Overwatch 2 just being a surprise launched one day.
Yeah, it's like, oh, this is out now. What? Like Diablo 4? Oh, it's out. Or it comes out next week. What? Like, build up hype for the game and then just like surprise the hell out of people with like a super short time to wait for it. Cause that is also a frustrating thing. Like, I am kind of sick of like release windows that are months in advance. Like, do you really need to tell me that something's going to be coming out in 9 months? I'm going to forget about it between now and then, or I'm just going to like get frustrated and almost will myself to forget about it until it actually comes out. And then like, okay, now that it's out, now I'll get excited for it because now I get to play it or now I get to watch it or whatever. Like,
I mean, with the release windows, unless you are going into a store, once you hear of the release window and making a pre-order for a physical copy, the people who are out there going to buy the game digitally, download it from whatever service to whatever your platform or console or game system is, knowing about something 3, 4, 6, 9 months in advance doesn't really provide any benefit to you, does it?
No. No, it doesn't.
Like, the only thing I can think of off the top of my head is maybe budgeting purposes?
I guess.
Like, oh, there's that game. Oh, I will want the premium edition of it with all the extra bells and whistles and crap and whatnot. I will need to scrounge up an extra few shekels for it. And you start scrounging accordingly with the runway of a couple months' knowledge and forewarning. But yeah, because you download the majority of your games, is there any action you can take knowing that something is coming 6 months down the line?
No, but even if I didn't download games, there's not really. Like, I wouldn't pre-order a game anyways, like, even if it was, like, to get the physical copy. Like, that doesn't – I've never been a person to go in for, like, the special editions of things or things like that anyways. And it's just, like, even – like, downloading is irrelevant in this context. It's just a matter of, like, okay, it's coming out in 9 months. Tell me in 9 months when it comes out. Then I'll buy it. Like, what are you doing? Like, unless it's like, it comes out next month and then we're going to like build hype every day with like a new video or something. Like, what's the point?
I don't know. I can't tell you off the top of my head. I don't know how many people are making a note of it in their phones, in their daily planner, on their calendar, whatever the case might be, to remind them that, oh yeah, this awesome game comes out, you know, 6 months down the line, 9 months down the line on this day. Okay, I'm going to put it in and be excited. Chances are, if it's a big enough game, something you're interested in, you will hear about it beyond just whatever reminder you could potentially set for yourself.
Exactly. Like I think about, like, the example of, like, the Elder Scrolls. Like, of course I want to play the new Elder Scrolls game, but what point is there in telling me, oh, we're working on the Elder Scrolls. Like, okay, fine. Just say, okay, we're working on an Elder Scrolls game. Why would you bother, like, even releasing any sort of trailer or something? Like, it's unnecessary. Like, confirmation is maybe nice, but, like, what if something happens between now and 5 years from now when you finish the game? Like, I don't know. It just seems weird to me.
And especially in the example you just cited of the Elder Scrolls and whatnot, it was Elder Scrolls and another game that, some space game whose title escapes me at the moment.
Starfield.
Starfield, thank you, that, were shown off last year, during E3. And they provided literally nothing because they were about 30-second trailers and they gave you no details other than to announce that they are projects in development, that they exist in the world, but, like, even in the Elder Scrolls one, you saw land. You saw some land and terrain and a few buildings far off in the distance, and then very diehard people in the community then set about trying to figure out what those buildings were and trying to discern what landmass the little reveal trailer was showing, which even then, if you dig into the information, if you look into it and compare it against whatever maps and data you have and learn, oh, it's this portion of the land in Elder Scrolls. Okay. What does that do for you?
Yeah, but even then, like, will you be mad when it's not? Because what if they just showed, oh, like, just render some land. Who cares? Just put something out there. What's to stop them from actually saying, oh, actually, you thought it was this place, but over the course of 300 years, the climate changed and, oh, now it's this place. Like, I don't know if there's any number of things they could have done. And it's like pointless to even speculate because it's like, it literally doesn't matter. We're like 5 years away from this game coming out. Why are you releasing a trailer? Like, if anything else, yeah, sure. Mentioning it's nice. Knowing that we're going to get another one is nice. But what am I going to do with a trailer for it when it's not even close to being done? Like, that's...
An example, sorry, that just kind of came to me as you were talking and keep mentioning, you know, what if something happens in between? Let's go back a couple years. Nintendo has that really quick teaser logo reveal for Metroid Prime 4. And then what happens like 6-9 months later? They scrap everything that was developed up to that point.
Yeah.
And they take it right back down to zero and start fresh with a new team, new eyes, new leads, new everything, or almost entirely new everything, to get a new Metroid Prime 4.
Yeah. So,
which then resets the clock and the dev cycle for that is now however many more years, 3-4 years away.
Yeah, so I think knowing that something's in development is nice, but like, yeah, that, I don't know. Companies gotta have, they're gonna have to stop this at some point because it's ridiculous. Like, what's the point? Unless Diablo 4 is coming out soon, like, I don't know, like, it's cool seeing how dark they're envisioning it, but yeah, I don't know.
I look at what CD Projekt Red did with Cyberpunk 2077. Like, they announced a couple years ago that it was in development and never showed anything.
Yeah,
and just then, anytime anyone would ask, they'd confirm, yeah, we're still working on it.
And then it's not even coming out till 2077, so what the hell? Sorry. But, how ridiculous would that be?
The longest development cycle for anything.
Oh man.
Take that, Chinese democracy. Take
yeah.
That Duke Nukem Forever.
Yeah, in your face, that film that I think John Malkovich is in that they're filming and then not going to release it for 100 years.
Oh, that's right too.
Yeah. Whatever that film was called. Anyways.
Yeah. Yes, but during that diatribe, I did mention Metroid Prime, which I think is kind of a nice segue into our Blast from the Past segment. If I may just kind of take us into the last portion of the show for this episode, which if you're not familiar with the program or what the Blast from the Past is a portion of the show where we kind of take some time towards the end of the program to really reminisce and wax nostalgic about some things that are celebrating milestone anniversaries. They could be games, movies, TV shows, music albums, anything that has caught our attention over years past that we think is worth revisiting and worth mentioning and talking about again to refresh your memory or perhaps introduce it to you for the first time. And our Blast from the Past segment this week has not one, not two, not three, but 4 video games for you because we are a video game podcast and there was just no way to parse through and pick one over the others or two over the others. So we have a glut of 4 games, 3 of which came out in a span of 3 days within the same year, and one is 10 years old. It came out on its own day. It stands alone, much like the cheese. So where would you like to start? I'm guessing, given the past precedent, you may want to start this segment going in reverse chronological order and starting with the youngest.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, especially considering the other 3, like, we sort of have, like, a lot to talk about, given that they came out almost on the same day, like, within the span of 3 days, and how they were all kind of milestone games. The newer of the four that we're going to talk about, still a good game, still a milestone game, I don't know, different gaming climate perhaps when it came out. But, the first one is the second game in a franchise that's still going, that was going harder at, you know, a couple of years after this for a while than it is now and back then. In 2009, it was released for the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360, and it was the second Assassin's Creed game.
It was indeed. This was the game that introduced players to the Italian protagonist of Ezio Auditore, De Firenze. I hope I pronounced that correctly. But even if I didn't, yeah. Oh well. But this was, I feel, the game that really launched the Assassin's Creed franchise. There was the first game set in the Holy Land, hundreds of years prior, but I mean, that had its charm. But this game being set in Renaissance era Italy in the 15th and early 16th century really hit its stride. And this, to me, is one of the best games in the Assassin's Creed franchise and had the aspect I really, really liked about the Assassin's Creed games, the ability just to go and explore. Once you got Assassin's Creed 2, fired it up and started figuring out your controls and your moveset and how to climb buildings, how to run up buildings, how to run and climb buildings, leap down from them and whatnot, it really felt like Italy became your playground, your sandbox, if you will, and there were no limits, seemingly, to what you could do in it. I think one of the first things I did once I got Assassin's Creed 2 and started playing it in earnest was I was running around, found what I thought was just a wall, started climbing up it, realized it was the Colosseum, and I climbed to the very top of the Colosseum, which took a while. The Colosseum is very large and very tall, but just being able to stand on top of the Colosseum, the still intact Colosseum at the time, mind you, and look around and just survey the landscape was just, had a certain amount of awe to it that you don't often get from a video game experience.
Yeah. The thing I remember the most about the game, I mean, I didn't really play it personally, but one of my siblings played the crap out of all these games, and the thing that I always thought was interesting was the inclusion of historical figures and how Leonardo da Vinci was basically like your Q.
Yeah, he was your tech guy, if you will, for the time.
Yeah, he was basically, you needed a cool crossbow, you needed like some interesting new weaponry, you needed like a stealth suit or something that would have been maybe period appropriate. Well, the person who you would go to talk to was Leonardo da Vinci. And he was a full-on person who was just there. And, I always thought that was so awesome. Like, he was just like, oh, there's Da Vinci. Okay, cool. And yeah, like, there's other characters as well in there, like, legitimate historical figures, like Niccolo Machiavelli, the Medici family, the Barbarigo family, and Pope Alexander the Sixth. Like, they're all in there, and like, their stories are actually told pretty accurately, like from what I understand. Like, I know my one sibling, as I said, she played all these Assassin's Creed games. And I remember when I think the show was The Borgias was on TV, like she was just like, I don't need to watch that. I know the whole story. And it's just like, what? It's like, wait a minute, what? And it's just like, yeah, through all these games, it's like, oh, you got to learn all these historical things. So it was weird how they were subtly teaching you history as well, even if you were just kind of like engaging in it in kind of a ludicrous, non-historical way. But it was just something I always thought was interesting about this franchise.
That to me was always one of the more interesting aspects, and yet it tries to then also tie in the more modern or futuristic storyline of the Animus and the Templars and Assassins and taking place in the future, and you're reenacting or reliving moments through the life of Ezio Auditore, but you're still that future character, which I always found the animus and the future aspect stuff to be the absolute weakest part of these Assassin's Creed games. Get me back into the historical times. Get me back running around these vast, beautifully rendered vistas. I mean, Italy for a game from 2009 looks pretty damn gorgeous in this game. Now, of course, you know, it's been upgraded and redone, you know, in years since, but for the time, it looked pretty damn good. And just that neat wow factor of just running up and down, going all around Italy as though it was your sandbox to play in, which was a fantastic experience. And then, oh yeah, there'd be cinematic cutscenes of whatever, but I don't care. I always enjoy the Ezio part. That's it. And yeah, they just can, Ubisoft, did that wonderful thing of, running the franchise into the ground for a period of time too with annual releases.
Yeah. Now granted, I mean, like, if you look at the number of Assassin's Creed games, it is kind of daunting. And technically, there were two direct sequels to, Assassin's Creed 2, Brotherhood and Revelations, I think it was. Both of which were pretty good as well. Similar setting, familiar setting, the same Italy setting before they moved on to Assassin's Creed 3, which was a different setting, and then Assassin's Creed 4, which was a different setting still. But yeah, Assassin's Creed 2, I think, might be the most fleshed out universe in the series.
Well, they certainly had the most time to tell that story, given that they had three games for that Ezio storyline, and basically setting it in Italy for the majority of that time. But yeah, Assassin's Creed 2, the big success that helped launch the Assassin's Creed franchise. Again, 1 was a solid game, but then 2 just kind of was rocket fuel, and I guess part of it too was the setting. Renaissance Italy. Like, you'll never be able to see that. It was gorgeous in the old world, and also, yeah, interacting with the Borgias and Da Vinci and whatnot. Awesome. 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 But let's move on from that and go back 5 years prior to 2004 to three different days, where there were solid games each day. Just a weird period in gaming history.
Yeah. Like we might as well just walk our way through the week as it would have happened, those 3 days as they would have happened in, you know, chronological order. The first game that got released on November 15th of 2004 was the second entry into the Metroid Prime series called Echoes.
Metroid Prime 2 being one of the biggest franchises for the GameCube at the time, and a breath of fresh air to the Metroid franchise, given that it skipped over the Nintendo 64, and then Nintendo and Retro Studios worked on Metroid Prime 1, which was just a gorgeous game for the GameCube at the time, and a very unique experience, giving people a first-person view of what it's like to be Samus.
Yeah.
And 2, very much continuing on in that vein, about as direct a sequel as you can, with the big part of Metroid Prime 2 Echoes being the inclusion of Dark Samus, the mysterious doppelganger that you have to battle in addition to battling the space pirates. But more or less, I've always kind of regarded Prime 1 and 2 as being extremely similar games.
Yeah. I admittedly didn't really get into the franchise at the time, because I guess at the time I had like an aversion to strictly first-person games, which actually we'll get to in a second, because I had it in my mind. Like, I didn't really like first-person shooters. You know, I had a couple of bad experiences where I didn't really have GoldenEye or Perfect Dark, and, you know, getting invited over to play these games with people and, you know, being made to feel not great at games at all, where it's just, when in reality it's just like, I don't have these games. You all have these games. You practice playing these games. Of course I'm going to be crappy at these games. I'm not having a good time. Like, you're all good at this game. And anyways, all that aside, like, so I had a little bit of an aversion for a while to first person shooter games, which, you know, I admittedly also didn't really give the Metroid Prime franchise a proper shake in the day. But you know, with, with the ever-looming Metroid Prime 4, I think maybe it might be a perfect time for me to dig back in and try to get back and, like, you know, play through these games since, you know, my aversion has been lifted. I play plenty of first-person games now. Yeah, it was a really gorgeous franchise. I know I remember looking, like seeing the games when they came out and thinking, holy crap, like, they kind of nailed the whole Metroid atmosphere thing, and then they just kind of put it in the three dimensions. It's really cool.
So that was the Monday of that week back in November of 2004. Again, Monday was Metroid Prime 2 Echoes, and then the next day, the Tuesday of that week, saw the release of Half-Life 2 for the PC.
Yeah, well, and then eventually every other system.
Well, yes, but the initial launch was on PC.
Yeah, so this is the game that made me kind of go back on the whole first-person shooter thing, because I realized it's like, I also kind of looked at this one, another first-person shooter game, but then I started seeing, oh, literally no one is giving this game a bad review. Everyone's saying it's maybe the best game of all time, game of the decade. It's a real work of art, blah, blah, blah. And I think I really do have to agree. It is an incredible game. Like, it really holds up. Story, like, I don't know what to say about Half-Life 2 that hasn't literally been said over the last 15 years. Like, it's kind of a shame that Valve doesn't want to finish the Half-Life story because, you know, they're just too busy making money with Steam and not being a game development studio anymore. But yeah, Half-Life 2 really is one of the high watermarks of gaming, I would say.
I know for me, it ranks as probably the best game I have ever played. In terms of technical achievement, diversity of experience, atmosphere, everything that the game has going on is absolute, is top notch.
Yeah.
It's a high watermark experience, like you said. It's a first person shooter. There's times it's intense, but times it's kind of a bit more subdued. It's not completely, I guess, aggressive all the time needlessly. It tells a great story. It breaks it up and yet has equally interesting side characters as well. Alex Vance is in there as a resistance fighter fighting alongside Gordon Freeman to free the clutches of the Combine from the city.
Yeah.
And I don't know how this game could be improved upon.
No, I don't think it can. Like, it's... Like, it really does the atmosphere well. It really does the characters well. It does storytelling in a very... I hadn't really experienced storytelling in the way that they did it in Half-Life 2 before Half-Life 2. And now it seems it's done commonplace. Like, this really was a game-changer game where, like, you know, a scene just kind of plays out whether or not you're there. And if you really want to be a part of it, you have to be there. Like, people will start talking to each other and you... Like, they'll start, like, they'll interact whether you're there or not, and you kind of should be there so you know what's going on. Like, that was kind of mind-blowing to me.
It was, and it does not take you out of the gameplay experience either, as Half-Life 2 actually, the Wikipedia entry for Half-Life 2 points out, there are no pre-rendered cutscenes to interrupt your gameplay or the flow of gameplay. It just seamlessly transitions. Not even transitions, it just unfolds in front of you. Which yeah. is not something we see happen these days. Not to any great extent, I should say, but certainly back then that was a unique approach, and I think is still a bit of a unique approach that you can... It gives the world a bit more feeling of life, in that this is actually a real experience you're having.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, a couple of, like, episodic sequels got released, but in, you know, like, 2 years later and 3 years later, respectively, but then those fizzled out, and we don't get to see the end of that story. So, basically, screw you, Valve, and also damn you for being so good at making games, and too bad you're never making games again, I guess, is the ultimate takeaway.
You see, making games would require a financial investment, and Valve would take on some level of liability. They may not recoup their investment, so they're better off just sitting on the sidelines with their feet up and letting money flow in.
Yeah, that's fair, I guess. But
that was the Tuesday of that week, and to cap it all off, the crazy 3 days of that week in November, the third and final of those just amazing games that came out on the Wednesday, November 17th, 2004, on the PlayStation 2, Metal Gear Solid 3, Snake Eater.
Yes, this is a game that I did actually play quite a bit of. Yeah, this game, in combination with Metal Gear Solid 2, like, you know, really kind of cemented Hideo Kojima as, like, the crazy genius he is in my mind. I mean, even if he didn't release any other games, even if he released nothing but terrible games after, I'd be like, no, he's still a genius. Metal Gear Solid 2 and 3, done.
And that's a very, very weighty argument you'd be leveling.
Yeah.
Right there. It's a unique approach in that instead of continuing on the story of Snake or Raiden, Hideo Kojima then goes back and uses this game to be an origin story, seemingly for the entire Metal Gear franchise.
Yeah, pretty much. Goes back to the 1960s, 1964, to be specific, actually. I think chronologically, this is actually the first game in the Metal Gear chronology, which got really weird and muddy because, like numerically speaking, like the first Metal Gear for NES technically takes place sort of in the middle of the entire, timeline. And then, you know, from there, like just look on Wikipedia for the whole timeline. It's kind of crazy. But yeah, this one is the first one where we really got to see, like, the snake in this game was actually not the snake that we saw in other games. There's a whole thing, you know, cloning is involved, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, we saw, you know, young Ocelot. We saw various other characters. We saw the boss. We saw, it's this game, whereas Metal Gear Solid 2 was sort of like a postmodern, like almost like an anti-war game in a weird, similar, like postmodern style, like GoldenEye might have been in. This game is like in a, like very much an homage to the like 1960s and early 70s, like James Bond movies, basically.
I can see that, but certainly a more interactive experience. And kind of in classic Kojima fashion for the Metal Gear games from that time, certainly 2, 3 continues it on, there's always these little quirks, little Easter eggs you can find that you may not have experienced in your playthrough, but then you'll talk to someone and they say, oh, I did this thing. And you're like, what, really? You can do that? I had the experience of that when I was in my playthrough of Metal Gear Solid 3 and actually was able to sniper off the character of the End, who was the main sniper old man character in the wheelchair, one of the four main boss characters in the game. And I was able to sniper him off from the first time you encounter him and see him in the game. It's at a great distance, but was able to take him out. And I think it was may have been you I was telling that to, and you had no idea, because once you do that, once you kill him, at the first point you can see him, you don't have to engage in a boss battle with him later, which I believe takes place in a jungle.
Oh, it is. Yeah. And it's a huge pain in the ass boss battle if you haven't done it. But another interesting thing, and it's like the wacky sense of humor of Hideo Kojima, another way that you can take out that same boss, because he's a very old man, you can actually set, like at least when it came out on PlayStation 2, you could set the system clock of the PlayStation ahead, I think, a month. And then like, if you save the game with one time, set the system clock ahead by a month, and then come back, you'll get a codec call saying that he died of natural causes. And then you also don't have to do the battle. My same sister who plays video games also, you know, played the crap out of in every Metal Gear Solid game, was the one that kind of discovered that because she heard about it and confirmed it. And I thought that was hilarious. It was like the messages that they put in. It's just like, oh, turns out you don't have to worry about this guy anymore. He died because he was old. It's like, wow. It's like, what? So, yeah.
Yep, and I believe there was also the... what's interesting about Snake Eater is that it was also redone a bit later with an expanded, almost director's cut version that came out a little bit later on called Subsistence that included some cutscenes, some deleted cutscenes, if you will, and I believe it was you who showed me there's one of those cutscenes on Subsistence that is of the general who just becomes obsessed with trying to get a handshake for
yes.
Snake.
Well, I don't, it's not clear if it's a general or who it is, but it's some diplomat who at the end of the game, like spoiler alert, whatever, like there's like a big, like it's, they're all anti-war games, but you know, there's a whole scene where Snake is a war hero and like there's a whole press conference thing happening. Then all these diplomats are kind of lined up all wearing suits and stuff and they have their hands out and Snake just walks right past them, doesn't shake their hands, sort of like a snub kind of thing. And then, you know, that's that in the game. But then, so it was called the Secret Theater of what you're thinking of. And it was all these alternate,
yes.
It was alternate cutscenes. I don't know if they were cutscenes, but like they were alternate cutscenes, maybe joke cutscenes. Some of them were just like weird movies that they put together. But, the one you're thinking of, instead, like when he walks by, instead of it being it, it zooms in on the diplomat and he's furious and he's just, the whole rest of the thing is just him trying to catch up with Snake to get that handshake until eventually they have a big like wrestling match and he wins and he puts his hand out and then Snake just has to shake his hand and they're in the middle of a field and then all of a sudden like all these like cameramen and stuff show up and like there's like a crowd clapping and it's just bizarre. The one I remember was the Time Paradox video because there was a character in Metal Gear Solid 3 that used the same character model as Raiden from Metal Gear Solid 2, but it was a very different character. I think it was Ivan, maybe it was Rydenovich or something, who was, you know, basically, I'm not going to get too far into what the character actually is, but he was not Raiden, but he looked exactly like Raiden, but they had, I guess they used him to be Raiden because like the whole premise of that one video, I think, was that Raiden was waiting for the call and found out that he wasn't going to be in the game. So then he went back in time and was trying to force his way into the game. And then he kept faking all these time paradoxes. It was just this really dumb video. I think it was actually called Metal Gear Stupid at the end of it, where it was just, I don't know. I think you can find all those videos on YouTube anyways. Just look for Metal Gear Solid 3 Secret Theater and you'll find all the ridiculous videos and you'll be blown away at how crazy they are and how they actually made it into an official release of the game and how, yeah, these are sanctioned by Hideo Kojima. So he's a crazy person.
He is a crazy man. He is absolutely a crazy man, but that does not detract at all from the experience or the artistic merit of Metal Gear Solid 3 Snake Eater celebrating its 15th anniversary alongside Metroid Prime 2 Echoes from the GameCube and Half-Life 2, first launched on the PC, all within a span of a couple days from 2004, which is crazy. It's crazy to think about.
Yeah.
And to kick off the Blast from the Past segment, we started off by talking about Assassin's Creed 2, which marks its 10th anniversary after it was initially launched on November 17th, 2009 for the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360. So, we've talked a lot I think we're both parched and we should probably wrap this episode up, which we shall do, but not before we thank you so much for joining us, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages. Glad you can join us and hope you can join us again next time. We certainly want to hear your thoughts. Were you someone who maybe during that crazy week in 2004 got each of the games on each of the days they came out? Let us know your thoughts and so much more. info@thearcadeshow.com. Or hit us up on social media. We are at The Arcade Show on Twitter and on Facebook, facebook.com/The Arcade Show. And while you're at it, if you have not already, which seems weird if you have made it to this portion of the show and haven't subscribed to our podcast already, it is available to subscribe to and get it sent straight to your device of choice every time there's a new episode. Direct links to our iTunes and Google Play podcast pages can be found on our homepage of thearcadeshow.com. So until next time, good night, everybody.
Good night.